Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
Hantavirus is dominating the news, but how much of what you're hearing is actually true? From the MV Hondius cruise ship outbreak to viral social media claims, misinformation is spreading almost as fast as the headlines. In this episode of Care Talk, Dr. Christina Madison, the public health pharmacist, cuts through the noise. Whether you're worried about exposure or just tired of the fear-mongering, this episode gives you the facts you need from a source you can trust. Welcome to Care Talk Live, a weekly American healthcare policy show and podcast where we explain how healthcare works or doesn't work and get you answers. I'm Laura Packard, cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, here to help you. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts to get future Care Talk shows. And so if you're concerned about what's going on with hantavirus, this conversation is for you. Dr. Christina Madison is a nationally recognized public health expert, clinical pharmacist, keynote speaker, media contributor, and health communication strategist known as the public health pharmacist. Welcome, Christina.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Good. So let's start with, first of all, in my extremely Midwestern way, am I even saying it right? Is it hantavirus or hantavirus, or does that matter?
It's hantavirus, but I would say that tomato, tomato. I think the point here is that it's definitely been dominating our current news cycle lately. And I'm hoping that after this conversation, I will calm some fears for the lay person out there that is wondering, oh my gosh, is this the next COVID-19 pandemic, especially because it originated on a cruise ship and it brought up so much PTSD from when we knew that there's cruise ships were out at port and were not docking because, the previous administration, which is now the current administration, did not want the COVID-19 cases to go up. So, yes.
So let's start with hantavirus. This comes from an animal. This is a zoonotic, so it's spread from animals to humans, right? Where is it from? How did this get started?
Yeah, so this started based off of an exposure that occurred from a cruise ship. So this cruise ship wasn't like a normal cruise ship, which is a lot of, partying and pool time and relaxation. This was actually an expedition trip. And so they docked in Argentina and got off the ship and did an expedition. And there were two passengers, a husband and wife, that were on that expedition and came in contact likely with some sort of rodent feces or had contact with, some debris that had come in contact with the rodents. And based off of that, they became infected with this version of hantavirus. And the Andes version is different than the hantavirus that we see typically, because normally we don't see sustained human-to-human transmission from other strains of hantavirus. And the reason why that's different and why it's become such an issue is because we are seeing folks that were not on the ship and did not have close contact with the persons, the two original people who got sick and unfortunately passed away, the husband and wife. They were actually exposed to people who docked and left the ship early, not realizing that they had become infected. And so those folks flew on an airplane. And then there were contacts that were in close contact on an international flight. And then those folks tested positive as well. So that's kind of where we're at right now. Everybody who was on the boat is now off the boat and has been repatriated to their country of origin. So there were several people that were from the United States that are now back here in the U.S. As of right now, the CDC is currently observing around 41 people for symptoms. The incubation period of this particular infection can be up to 8 weeks. So these folks will be, they're going to be observed for at least 42 days to see if they do develop symptoms. Because again, the symptoms associated with hantavirus are very, what we call non-specific. So it's fever, it's cough, it's chills. It's feeling fatigued. So it's not very specific. And so really the thing that distinguishes this from other infections is whether or not they had contact with someone from that cruise ship or not.
Mm-hmm. And so hantavirus was in the news several months ago because the actor Gene Hackman, his wife, died of hantavirus in I think New Mexico. But the version of hantavirus that was and is in some rodents in the United States is not the same version that's circulating in South America. Is that right?
Yes. So the one that was the version or the strain from the one that Gene Hackman's wife passed away from, that one is not the type of hantavirus that can be transmitted from close contact from person to person. So when they went in and they went into the home and they found there was actually quite a bit of rodent feces in the home when they found them deceased. And so they're pretty sure that that was where she contracted it from. But again, different strain of hantavirus, not the Andes version, which again can be transmitted from person to person. So the type of hantavirus she had, she couldn't give it to anyone else, even if she was sick. So, you know, unfortunately, Gene Hackman likely passed away because he lost his caregiver after she passed away.
Mm-hmm. And so something that people can take away from this show is that you should not have rodents in your house. Right. And if you
I
have
think that's a big one. And if you're somebody who likes to be like outdoorsy, just try to stay away from anything that's, you know, small and brown, small rodent and brown.
Yes. But for this particular cruise ship borne outbreak, there's not a whole lot that Americans need to be doing or consider doing right now because the likelihood of spread is low.
Yeah. And the biggest thing, too, that I want folks to know is that everyone who has had even cursory or very distant contact with somebody who was on the cruise ship, they've been identified and are under quarantine protocol. And so there are folks that are a little bit more ill. Those folks are being seen at the facility in Nebraska. And then there are folks that have no symptoms right now and just had less close contact. And those folks are being asked to what we call convalesce at home. So reporting if they have any symptoms, reporting if they've had any changes in their health status. But ultimately, as of today, those 41 people that are under observation, none of them have tested positive. And so I think that's really good news because, again, there were some cases of folks that maybe were in a row that were several seats behind the person, and they were concerned that maybe that they had something because they came in with a very, non-specific viral symptoms. And so they went in and that person was tested and initially was they called it a very, a medium or a small positive or slightly positive, and then ended up telling them later that it was actually a false positive. And so I think that's, the point here is that we want to not be fear mongers. We want to be calm mongers. We want folks to be calm and to really let them know that this is not a COVID-19 situation, that, the likelihood of sustained human to human transmission, especially from very casual contact, is not how this infection spreads. You have to have very close contacts. We're saying things like sleeping in the same bed with this person, being in a very, small, confined space with the person that is infected. And not just that they're infected, but that they're symptomatic. And I think that's also a point that gets missed with some of the commentary that you're seeing online. I know there's been lots of different TikTok videos and YouTube videos of what I like to call armchair physicians and healthcare professionals out there giving their take about this infection. But ultimately, the 41 people are being observed. The CDC is now in contact with WHO. We have now repatriated all of the folks that were on that cruise ship. And now it's just a waiting game to see if these people end up becoming symptomatic and do end up testing positive, because unfortunately there is no vaccine and there is no approved treatment for hantavirus. So it really is what we call symptomatic management. So we want to get them access to care as soon as possible so that they don't progress to the phase of the infection, which is the cardiopulmonary phase, which is what leads to, unfortunately, leads to death.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons why people are so concerned, well, first of all, we just had a global pandemic, but yes. Second of all, the gutting of public health infrastructure in our country, news coming out that penile implant specialist is in charge of infectious diseases for the United States government. You know, they, story headlines that you think couldn't possibly be true, and yet they
only out. In the U.S. of A., honey.
So, what do you say to people that rightfully have concerns about America's public health infrastructure right now?
Well, I would say this. Even though the folks that maybe are considered at the top of our leadership, you do have to remember there are career professionals and CDC disease detectives that have been doing this work for years. Yes, I will say that there are much less of them than there were a year ago because of the cuts that have been sustained by HHS and, of course, the CDC. But the folks that are there, that are left, know what they're doing. And so I think part of the challenge is that we did pull out of WHO. So there is that. So there was a little bit of a lack of communication in the beginning. So I do think that that is very valid that folks were like, hey, what's going on? This cruise ship initially left April 1st. And so why is it that we're just now hearing about this? Because those folks who passed away, I think mid-April. So I think that the communication was slower than it would have been if we had a, robust and fully staffed CDC. They also got rid of the people who do cruise ship maintenance. So didn't know if you knew that as well, which the cruise ship industry paid for, but they fired those people, unfortunately. So again, the communication is slower, but the folks that are there do know what they're doing. I will say that folks like yourself who are bringing this to the public's attention, my colleagues at the Evidence Collective, as soon as we heard that this was becoming an evolving story that needed to have some really strong debunking of mis and disinformation, we put out a brief pretty much right away telling what the facts were and what we knew as of that time. And I do think that that was really helpful to alleviate some of the fears that people had, especially because, again, this seems very reminiscent of what we just went through with COVID-19.
Absolutely. And finally, what sources would you recommend people go to for accurate evidence-based information about the hantavirus epidemic or about Ebola or any sort of emerging public health threats?
So I would, right now I would definitely still go to CDC. They are still meeting. They are still reviewing these cases. You can even go to the Nebraska Institute where the folks are also being observed right now. They are doing periodic updates around the patients that they have at their facility, as well as the folks that are convalescing at home. I would also recommend looking at WHO and the Evidence Collective as well. We put out briefs, and then my colleague, Dr. Jessica Steyer, who recommended me for your podcast today at Unbiased Science, and then your local epidemiologist are great resources, and you can find them on your social media du jour or on their Substack.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us, doctor, and stay healthy.
Oh, yeah, because now we have to deal with Ebola.
Thanks again for joining us. And a reminder that we have free or low-cost healthcare resources available on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. So check it out. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. And now our experts will start answering your health insurance questions. So welcome to Louise Norris, Health Insurance and Healthcare Reform Analyst at healthinsurance.org, and Diane Archer, Founder and President of Just Care USA. So let's start with Louise to talk about rule changes that CMS just finalized and what people need to know.
Sure. So every year, CMS finalizes a whole set of changes, rule changes that apply to marketplace plans. And they just finalized the one for 2027. It's a huge rule, like 1,100 pages long. So it encompasses a lot of stuff. Some of the things that consumers will start to see either later this year or like as we go into open enrollment that starts in November for coverage effective in 2027. Just a few things I wanted to highlight that people will see. First of all, for 2027 plans, they have finalized a rule change where they're going to allow some bronze marketplace plans to have out-of-pocket maximums as high as $15,600. As opposed to the rule they had already finalized that was applied across all plans, employer-sponsored plans, marketplace plans, was going to be $12,000 was going to be the upper limit no matter what. So now what they're doing is they're saying it can be a little higher, well, quite a bit higher, 30% higher, $15,600 for certain bronze plans. And the reason for this is because what's been happening is bronze plan deductibles have been creeping higher and higher and are basically at the point now where in a lot of cases the deductible is as high as the out-of-pocket maximum that's allowed, because if they have lower deductibles then the plan ends up being doesn't fit in the bronze category anymore basically. So it was sort of running up against numbers that were impossible to make it work. So by pushing the maximum out-of-pocket higher on these plans, they allow the plans to have lower deductibles and still fit within the bronze category. So consumers just need to be aware of this change, because if you go in the fall in November and you're looking at plans for 2027 and you see a lower premium plan, which that is the other point of these is premiums can be lower, and then you also see a lower deductible, people might not realize that the total out-of-pocket exposure is so much higher. So as long as you go into it with your eyes wide open and you understand that in a worst case scenario, you are paying $15,600 out of your pocket, it's basically just sort of the ever-present reminder of don't just look at the deductible, make sure you look at the full out-of-pocket exposure. So that's just a heads up for open enrollment that's coming in November. And then a couple other changes that'll happen this year are they are reinstating more eligibility verification sort of documentation requirements for people who are enrolling through a special enrollment period when you have a qualifying life event. Basically, you're going to assume you're going to need to provide proof of that qualifying life event, even if in the past few years you didn't have to. And then also income verification is going to get tighter. If you are applying for a marketplace plan and you say that your projected income is higher than the federal poverty level, but what they have on file for your last tax return shows lower than the federal poverty level, they are going to require proof of your income. So this is just nothing actually changes about who's eligible for marketplace subsidies, but you are going to need to plan to provide documentation. There were some other changes that they had proposed about, like, higher out-of-pocket limits on catastrophic plans, for example, that got pushed to 2028. So some of the, not all of the rule changes that they proposed back in February got finalized, but those three that I just mentioned did get finalized, and people will be seeing that in the marketplace this year.
Thank you, Louise. And our next question came in via voicemail. This is or Diane, what is your opinion about Medicare Advantage plans attached to a local hospital system, and how might they be better than a national carrier?
It's a great question. I want to start just by repeating, I'm sounding like a broken record, I know, that every Medicare Advantage plan is different, and many important differences cannot be detected by anybody. But one difference is that some Medicare Advantage plans are connected to local hospitals. The problem is that we don't know whether that local hospital is a hospital that's putting profits first or putting patient care first. So let me just start by saying that when I say that Medicare Advantage plans operate all differently, what I mean is that they all have different networks, they have different prior authorization rules, and they have different denial and delay rates. And all of those can affect in a very significant way the healthcare you get. They also all have different out-of-pocket cost calculations and out-of-pocket limits. So the amount you spend in a Medicare Advantage plan can vary by plan. And since we don't know which plan this is, we have no idea what the out-of-pocket limit is. We don't know if it's a for-profit or a not-for-profit, but we also just don't know how good the care is going to be. And that's just because there's such poor data. Do not rely on the fact that a plan has 5 stars. That is nothing like a 5-star hotel. The 5 stars can be for metrics that are satisfied, but those will not include prior authorization. That won't include the size of the network and whether the network is actually giving you access to the doctors you need to see. And it doesn't include delay and denial rates. So you just don't know in any given Medicare Advantage plan. I couldn't tell you, and it's all I do every day is look at these plans, whether you'll be able to get the care you need from the hospital provider in the instance you're describing, or in any other, from any other provider, depending upon the Medicare Advantage plan you have. So the best way to ensure that you're going to get the care you need, I have to emphasize, is if you're in traditional Medicare, because traditional Medicare covers your care from the physicians and hospitals you want to see anywhere in the country. And the government does not come between you and your treating physician in almost any case. In Medicare Advantage, there are just routinely lots and lots of prior authorization processes involved and delays of care as a result, and then sometimes too denials of care, and then you're required to appeal the denial, and maybe you'll win. You're likely to win if you appeal, but you've had to go through this long process in order to get the medically necessary services that your doctor and you wanted. And that's what's so hard with Medicare Advantage. You just have no clue what you're getting yourself into. I say you're gambling with your health and sometimes with your life.
Thank you, Diane. The next question is for Louise. My dental insurance rate is going up a lot this year, so I want to step down to a cheaper dental plan with less coverage. So for dental, vision, or health insurance not through the Affordable Care Act marketplace, is there an open enrollment period, or are you generally able to cancel or change plans whenever you want?
So for health insurance not through the marketplace, yes, they have the same open enrollment period as marketplace health insurance, because individual market coverage has to be fully ACA compliant regardless of whether it's purchased through the marketplace or not. So if you're going directly to a health insurance company to buy individual market coverage, you can't do that till November unless you have a qualifying event. But dental and vision is different. If you are not buying it through the marketplace, you can sign it, you can cancel whenever, you can enroll whenever. the one of the catches with dental and vision coverage like that is that they often have a waiting period before they will cover anything that's not just preventive care. So like your cleanings and x-rays would generally be covered right from the get-go, but more significant services like maybe a crown, a root canal, anything like that will generally have a waiting period, but they will often waive the waiting period if you can show proof that you've had prior coverage. So if you drop one company's plan, sign up for another company's plan, and you can show proof of prior coverage, you may find that they waive the waiting period. Not all companies have waiting periods. Sometimes they use a different system where they might cover, X amount of dollars towards a major service in the first year you have the plan, and then the second year they bump it up to a higher level, and the third year they bump it to a still higher level, just to encourage longevity. And basically they aren't going to do like a big payout right away when you get a plan. That's kind of a general rule of thumb, unless you can show proof of prior coverage. So it very much depends from one company to another. Outside the marketplace, dental and vision plans aren't regulated the way like health insurance policies are. So always read the fine print. There's a ton of variation from one plan to another in terms of how much they cover, what the maximum annual benefit cap is, although it's usually not very high, whether there's waiting periods, what services have a waiting period, whether the benefits bump up from 1 year to the next. So you never want to assume that what you had on a previous plan is going to be the same as what you get on a new plan. But in answer to the first question, yeah, you can sign up whenever.
Thank you, Louise. And then a question from Susan on Twitter, who wants to know, how do we fight Medicare for denying a drug used off-label by thousands of mostly elderly women to reverse precancerous cells? It's routinely used in gynecological care to avoid costly surgeries, but Medicare won't pay for it. The drug/device costs $4,000. So, Diane, what do you do if Medicare denies a drug used off-label?
Great question. You're always going to appeal, but let's start this conversation by sort of identifying what the drug is. We don't know what it is, and a lot also depends on the drug. So is the drug FDA approved? It sounds like it is because it's being used off-label. If it's not FDA approved, it's not worth appealing because as a general rule, Medicare will not pay for any drugs that are not FDA approved. But if it is FDA approved, then the question becomes, is this a drug that you buy at the pharmacy that you administer yourself, or one that's administered in hospital? And are you in traditional Medicare or in a Medicare Advantage plan? If you are buying it at the pharmacy, much like Medicare Advantage plans, every Part D plan is different. And each one will decide based on its own protocols whether to approve a drug for off-label use. But if you are denied coverage, whether you're in traditional Medicare or in a Medicare Advantage plan, you can appeal. And what you're going to want is a letter from your treating physician, the physician who prescribed the drug, explaining why this drug is reasonable and necessary for your condition, what the literature says about the value of the drug and why it will benefit you and potentially save money in the long run. If the drug is administered at the hospital and you have not received the drug, the hospital does not want to assume the cost of the drug. So there you're going to have to ask the hospital to submit the bill to Medicare if you're in traditional Medicare with, again, justification as to why this drug is needed under Medicare Part B. And again, if it is FDA approved and if the literature supports its use, then Medicare might ultimately pay for it. If you're in a Medicare Advantage plan, it's a slightly different story. But again, the hospital or the Part B, it's really Part B, the physician in the hospital will need to be making the claim. The Medicare Advantage plans are all different, as we've talked about. It's not likely they're going to pay for a drug that's off-label because that costs them money any benefit that they pay for or that they don't pay for is money in their pocket. So again, it's going to be a fight, but people who appeal denials in most cases of Medicare Advantage win. In this case, again, it's off-label use, so it's a little bit of a heavier lift in Medicare Advantage, I would imagine.
Thank you, Diane. And thank you, everyone, for joining us to learn more about hantavirus and answers to your questions on health insurance and healthcare in America. Be sure to check out our free and low-cost resources at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. Join us next week for more, and be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk.
Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.